So tonight's sutta is sutta number 22 from the Majjhima Nikaya, and I'm actually just looking at verses 13 and 14, called the Simile of the Raft. This is, number one, quite a famous sutta, and number two, one of my absolute favorites, which is why I chose it to start this process. So I'm just going to read a page or so of sutta here, and then we'll talk about it. Bhikkhus, I shall show you how the Dhamma is similar to a raft, being for the purpose of crossing over, not for the purpose of grasping. Listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, venerable sirs, the bhikkhus replied. Lesson one said this. Bhikkhus, suppose a man in the course of a journey saw a great expanse of water, whose near shore was dangerous and fearful, and whose further shore was safe and free from fear. But there was no ferry boat or bridge for going to the far shore. Then he thought, this is a great expanse of water, whose near shore is dangerous and fearful, and whose further shore is safe and free from fear. But there is no ferry boat or bridge for going to the far shore. Suppose I collect grass, twigs, branches, and leaves, and bind them together into a raft, and supported by the raft, and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the far shore. And then the man collected grass, twigs, branches, and leaves, bound them together into a raft, and supported by the raft, and making an effort with his hands and feet, he got safely across to the far shore. Then when he had got across, and had arrived at the far shore, he might think thus. This raft has been very helpful to me, since supported by it and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the far shore. Suppose I were to hoist it on my head or load it on my shoulder and then go wherever I want. Now, bhikkhus, what do you think? By doing so, would that man be doing what should be done with the raft? No, venerable sir. By doing what would that man be doing what should be done with that raft? Here, bhikkhus, when the man got across and had arrived at the far shore, he might think thus. This raft has been very helpful to me, since supported by it and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the far shore. Suppose I were to haul it onto the dry land or set it adrift in the water and then go wherever I want. Now, bhikkhus, it is by so doing that the man would be doing what should be done with that raft. So I have shown you how the Dhamma is similar to a raft, being for the purpose of crossing over, not for the purpose of grasping. So that's the actual sutta. And this is it's a quite a dense piece of language. And what I want to do is very carefully unpack it. To see all of the things that are going on here. And it starts that there's this guy and he's just on his journey and he's comes to a place where there's water in the way of him getting across to the other side. In other versions of this teaching and in other places where this image is used, they talk about not just a wide body of water, but a flood of water. And the problem is where he is now, the shore he's on is dangerous. And this is where we have to start, because we have to understand, well, why is this shore dangerous? Because remember, this is all an image about what's going on in our mind. These are images about how our mind works, an understanding of how to then work skillfully with that mind to get to the far shore. So why is it dangerous? Well, it isn't the world itself. It isn't the physical world itself that's dangerous. It's our habitual reactive patterns of mind, our tendencies towards greed, hatred, and delusion. The safe shore, the other side, is a place where we have learned equanimity, where we've learned to not be reactive. And so really what we're talking about here is right understanding, the first step on the Eightfold Path. You know, we have to understand that our habitual patterns of mind are dangerous, not necessarily in the physical sense, but in the mental sense, in the emotional sense, in the spiritual sense. It's those reactive patterns of mind, those tendencies to greed and hatred and delusion, that create all of our suffering and the suffering of everyone else around us. And so we have to come to this right understanding that we have to get to the other shore, because this shore doesn't work. And this seems almost like an unpleasant view of the world. But I want to talk some more about this. Basically, this body of water, this flood, is just this continuous flow of thoughts that we're always having. I mean, basically, we're always thinking. We always have this flow of thoughts. And sometimes it seems like a flood. Sometimes it seems overwhelming, right? I mean, it's just like the nature of being a human being. Sometimes it's like, oh my God, look at all this stuff here. And we get caught in memories of the past and thoughts about the future. And we're not grounded in the present moment at all. And so what is this flood made out of? What are all the aspects of this flow of thoughts that is always going on? And there's a book by someone named Ajahn Susito, a book called Paramis, which I really like, and he actually goes into great detail, but he talks about this flood quite succinctly. And so the first of these places where thoughts arise is what he calls the flood of sensuality. We sense experiences that we label pleasant or unpleasant. We either go after more or we try and avoid. That's the first layer of the flood, the first aspect, the first current of the flood, shall we say, to stick with the image. And I want to just read you briefly what he has to say about this. So, with some experience and considered attention, we can note that none of these, once seen, heard, actually induce the kind of feeling that the current promises in any but the most fleeting way. In the gentle or pulsing waves of this flood, however, the objects of the senses seem irresistible, charming, and productive of real satisfaction. And yet the manifest truth of our lives is that we are not blissed out or even satisfied for long by any sense contact. It happens all day long, and with luck, it's mostly okay. Sometimes it's pleasant for a short while, and sometimes it's unpleasant, but the pleasant, once established, gets to be normal and then boring. So a desire for newer sources of pleasure kick in. However, we can't really have any of it because it runs through consciousness like water through our fists. Sensory input with its pleasure and pain passes. So that's the first layer, of this flood of thoughts that we're always experiencing, that never ceases. Then we have what is called the flood of becoming. The ideas that we have, the thoughts that we have that center around the passing of time, and our own identity in that passing of time. There are like thoughts of the past, things that we remember, and thoughts of the future. The thing about these thoughts is that that those things that we were looking at in the past and things we're planning about in the future are really only just thoughts in the mind happening right now. That's all they are. They're just thoughts that are arising in the mind right now. Past is past. Future, who knows? You know, just look at what happened, you know, 6 months ago. Right now, I thought I was going to be on a retreat. Ha, ha, ha. But, you know, life changes just like that, you know, and you know, sometimes a lot quicker than 6 months, obviously. So let's just see what Ajahn Susito says about this as well. And yet there's a current in the mind that creates a felt identity who was, is, and will be. Rolling on its surface are worries and expectations about what I will be, nostalgia and regret about what I was. A conceit may form, having been this, surely I deserve to become that. Or its negative form, I've never been this, so I'll never become one of those. There's a lot of drama and suffering and stress in this flood, so much so that we fail to question, who is this character? It's like we never stop to think that all these thoughts about the past and plans for the future involve someone. And we never stop to think, well, wait a second, who is that that this story involves? You know? And it's a good question to ask. And then the third flood is what Ajahn Sujito calls the flood of views, which is an extension of the previous one. So the views are like deep-rooted ideas of how things are. This is how things are. This is how the world is. This is how things operate. And these views are so deep often. They're results of the way we were brought up and the culture we grew up in and our sexuality and thousands of other influences, right? But they're like so deep, we don't even see them as views. It's just like how things are. And actually they're not. They're just really deep habitual patterns of thought, views, that undetected push us mentally in all kinds of unhealthy directions, unwholesome directions, sometimes in wholesome directions too, by the way. I mean, it's not always necessarily unhealthy, but preponderantly to dangerous places in the mind. And then the final thing he mentions in his list is the flood of ignorance, of not seeing things as they really are, impermanent, unsatisfactory, and not self. And this flood is the underground current supporting the other three. It's another layer deep than the first three, the flood of sensuality, the flood of becoming, and the flood of views. There's this deep underlying ignorance that doesn't see things as they really are, you know, doesn't have right understanding. And it's the dawning of right understanding that allows us to start thinking about crossing the flood. We've seen how dangerous this shore is. Now let's get off this shore. But then we start thinking things like, oh, I'm not ready yet. I need to be better, purer, more holy. I have to wait till I have more time and when I'm not so busy, right? Before we try and cross over. So now we need to come to the what's needed next. Before we haven't even got to the edge of the water yet. Eh? We're just thinking about it. Now we have to think about forming wholesome intention. We have to actually form the intention I am going to go across. I'm going to cross that body of water. I'm going to get through the flood. Somehow or other, I'm going to go across. But then the immediate problem arises, as it says in the sutra, but there's no ferry and there's no bridge. So how can I get across? There's no way to make it easy. We can't sort of just stroll across the bridge or pay someone to take us across. You know, no, sorry, we have to somehow or other get across ourselves. That's where the intention has to be, that we're going to somehow get across ourselves. And then there's this great description of the raft. Suppose I collect grass, twigs, branches, and leaves and bind them together into a raft. Doesn't sound like a great raft, does it? Like some twigs and leaves and a few branches, and we tie them together somehow with some vines or something, I don't know. And this is going to get us across the flood. And it's like, so then instead what we go is, oh, I need a raft that's better. I need a better raft. You know, I want to cut some logs. I'm going to get them square and fit them together, and I'm going to make a mast and a sail and put a little house on the raft so I can keep all my stuff in it. And then when I have this really, really good raft, then I'll be ready to go across. Because then it'll be easy, right? I've done all this. I've got this great raft now that's going to get me across. And that's just us making excuses. That's what our mind does. I need to somehow make this better. I can't just, you know, take some stuff that's right there. And that's what the simile is saying is, actually, all we need is right there around us. Just the twigs and the grass, you know, just stuff that's there, right, immediately at hand, with no effort on our part. We just sort of gather them together, a little bit of effort to gather them together. And then we're ready to go out on the raft and try to go across the flood. We don't have any need to make big preparations or big serious plans. We just need to decide to do it. We just need to go right now, just as we are. We have everything we need right now, without exception. We all have that right there. This is where the Buddha says we all have Buddha nature. We all have bodhicitta. We all have that capability to cross the flood. It's innate. It's part of our nature. So then the problem arises. This is one problem after another, right? We look at this sort of flimsy raft that we're going to use to propel ourselves across this body of water, you know, using our hands and our feet. Well, for sure, we're going to get really wet. It's just like inevitable, right? This is not like a, you know, a deluxe raft where I'm going to sit on my deck chair. This is like I have to get down in the water on this little raft made out of twigs and grass and use my hands and feet to get across. I'm going to get wet for sure. And this is something we don't want to think about. We don't want to get wet. It's another thing, another deterrent from us actually trying to cross the flood. The last thing we want to do is get all wet. How unpleasant. Ugh. Right? And I want to read a couple of things here. This is from Dana Falls, and it's called Awakening. Awakening, can I withstand the radiance? When the goddess gazes from my eyes, when my heart opens wide, when the current of life sweeps me far from safety, when even the illusion of control is lost, and what is left to me is love, can I breathe a prayer of gratitude and praise? Unlike the winter groundhog, can I raise my face to the sun and not run from the shadow that embodied I will always cast in daylight? Well, to do this practice, we have to get wet. We have to deal with the unpleasantness of this, of what arises. Because what's going to arise as we practice, as we're going across the flood, remember, this is a flood of thoughts. This is our own mind, our own thoughts. This flood of thoughts, we're going to come across all that stuff that we don't want to think about, that we've stuffed away, that we've tried to ignore, that's unpleasant, that might be embarrassing even, right? I want to read another thing. This is from a famous Dharma book. This is the book's called The Velveteen Rabbit. Very famous. Actually, it's a very wonderful Dharma book. What is real? Asked the rabbit one day when they were lying side by side near the nursery fender before Nana came to tidy the room. Does it mean you have things that buzz inside you and a stick out handle? Real isn't how you're made, said the skin horse. It's a thing that happens to you when a child loves you for a long, long time, not just to play with you, but really loves you. Then you become real. Does it hurt? Asked the rabbit. Sometimes, said the skin horse, for he was always truthful. When you are real, you don't mind being hurt. Does it happen all at once, like being wound up? He asked, or bit by bit? It doesn't happen all at once, said the skin horse. You become. It takes a long time. That's why it doesn't often happen to people who break easily or have sharp edges or have to be carefully kept. Generally, by the time you are real, most of your hair has been loved off and your eyes drop out and you get loose in the joints and very shabby. But these things don't matter at all, because once you are real, you can't be ugly, except to people who don't understand. I suppose you are real, said the rabbit, and then he wished he hadn't said it, for he thought the skin horse might be sensitive. But the skin horse only smiled. The boy's uncle made me real, he said. That was a great many years ago. But once you are real, you can't become unreal again. It lasts for always. The rabbit sighed. He thought it would be a long time before this magic called real happened to him. He longed to become real, to know what it felt like. And yet the idea of growing shabby and losing his eyes and whiskers was rather sad. He wished he could become it without these uncomfortable things happening to him. Pure Dhamma. It's the problem. We don't want to have to deal with all of that unpleasant stuff that's in that flood. We have to actually directly experience the contents of our mind. And we have to accept the shadow, you know, the dark side, which is there. And we have to accept it, acknowledge it, be okay with it. We can't sail over our thoughts. We have to get right down in the flood and use our arms and legs to paddle across. As scary as that might seem, we have to get wet. Have to jump in and get wet. So there's another place where this idea of the raft is found in the sutta that I want to go to here. This is from the Samyutta Nikaya. The Samyutta Nikaya, Samyutta means collected. So this is from the collected discourses. And this is basically a collection of discourses on a particular theme or having a particular sort of form. And the first section of the Samyutta Nikaya is where devas and brahmas, higher beings, came down to be instructed by the Buddha. This is something, a very common theme in the teachings. And I ask simply that you suspend any disbelief about higher beings and devas and brahmas. If it makes you feel uncomfortable, it's okay. Think of them as wonderful people or whatever. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Savatthi in Jetta's Grove, Anathapindika Park. Then, when the night had advanced, a certain devata of stunning beauty, illuminating the entire grove, approached the Blessed One. Having approached, he paid homage to the Blessed One, stood to one side, and said to him, "How, dear sir, did you cross the flood?" "By not halting, friend, and by not straining, I crossed the flood." "But how is it, dear sir, that by not halting and by not straining, you crossed the flood?" "When I came to a standstill, friend, then I sank. But when I struggled, then I got swept away. It is in this way, friend, that by not halting and by not straining, I crossed the flood." So here now we're talking about the actual process. Here we are out in the middle of the flood on our raft. Now what do we do? And what the Buddha is saying here, it's not straining, but not halting. So it's this balanced approach of skillful action and skillful effort. Somehow we have to figure out a way that we don't strain too hard, but we don't stop. We don't stand still. If we strain, if we try too hard, we just end up making the practice really grim. And we're swept away because we become exhausted and discouraged. All those thoughts in the flood about, oh, this is too hard, oh, I'll never do this, they all arise and they sweep us away. When we strain, we just get wetter. We splash, you know, it's like, oh, I'm gonna go, and we're just like making bigger splashes and bigger, we're just getting wetter and wetter and wetter and wetter. We just become overwhelmed by our thoughts and emotions. If we halt, we sink. We just get swallowed up by this flood of thoughts and emotions, mental formations that are, is constantly flowing. It's because we lose the strength of practice that we've gained, and we have to start all over again. The only issue here is we have to start all over again, but we also have, hopefully, the knowledge we've gained by the previous attempt, or shall we say, attempts, plural, perhaps many, right? So we have that much. We've gained something by having learned. This is why daily practice is so strongly emphasized in this tradition, and in all meditative traditions for that matter, and why on retreat, continuity of practice has such strong emphasis. It's so that we don't stop, because if we stop, we sink. There's another way to look at this image too, I think. We halt because we cling to the pleasant in our practice. You know, we've come a certain way in our practice, and it's just, you know, we sit and it's just, it's so sweet and so wonderful, and I get so calm and steady and still, and I'm so focused. And we forget that we're trying to get across the flood. And the flip side of that is we strain when we are averse to the unpleasant things that are arising in our practice, which is inevitable. You know, we're living in the world of 10,000 joys and 10,000 sorrows. And if we think all we're going to get in meditation is the 10,000 joys and we're not going to get any of the 10,000 sorrows, we're being very unrealistic about our practice. It's going to happen. And we have to be okay with that. Another thing that stops us is fear of failure. It's like, why should I even bother? I'm not going to succeed anyway. It seems way too much to expect that someday I'm going to get to the other side. So let's look at this sutta again. What does the Buddha say? He says, when I came to a standstill, friend, then I sank. But when I struggled, then I got swept away. What the Buddha is saying here is, I failed many times. If the Buddha can fail, I think it might be okay that we fail too. And this is part of the nature, and that's why they call this practice. It isn't performance, it's practice. Practice implies that there's going to be times when it doesn't go so well, when you sink or you get swept away. And then you just, as I said, you just start again. And it's okay that that's what happens. This is like normal, how things are. And it's the thought, I'll just start again. And how do we get to that thought? Often the best way to get to that thought is to go back to our original intention. What was the intention that made us start trying to get across in the first place? Go back to and sort of tune into that original intention, and that's what's going to spark that energy, that effort to start again and again and again. Just intention, remember, is sort of the central teaching of the Buddha in some senses. It's like everything comes from intention. But then, presumably, some people actually get to the other shore. There's this wonderful book called First Buddhist Women. And in this is a collection of Dharma poems, enlightenment poems of the Buddha's original women disciples, who were many, and who reached enlightenment just as the bhikkhus, the men, did. And they had this wonderful thing where they wrote a brief poem that sort of expressed how that happened. What was that like? This is Uttama's story. 4 or 5 times I left my cell. I had no peace of mind, no control over my mind. So she started it again and again. Huh? I went to a nun I thought I could trust. She taught me the Dhamma, the elements of body and mind, the nature of perception, and earth, water, fire, and wind. I heard what you said. I sat cross-legged 7 days full of joy. When on the 8th I stretched my feet out, the great dark was torn apart. So what she's describing here is having reached the other shore. This is an actual description of her experience of reaching the other shore, of having gone through the flood. But this is tricky. Because, you know, then in the sutta, of course, the Buddha says, well, once you're on the other shore, then you don't need the raft anymore. Remember, the raft is the Dhamma. the teachings of the Buddha. Once you've reached the other shore, now you don't need the teachings anymore. We can't cling even to the teachings. This is a tough one for me. It's like I go, yeah, but is what my mind goes every time I think of this that way. But that's what, it's very clear what he's saying. It's like the trick is there's this danger that we let go too soon, thinking that somehow, oh, I'm on the other shore. So once we're on the other shore, we can let go of technique, let go of even the present moment. The Dhamma, the teachings of the Buddha, are simply skillful means to take us to the other shore. They're not something we have to hold on to tightly. We have to, as skillful means, use them, practice them. I mean, all of the Buddha's teachings are basically descriptions of how to practice. That's all he ever talked about, how to practice. And so we have to understand that at some point we have to let go. But how will we know? How do we know when to let go? That's the big question. And this is a question that the Buddha often got asked. This is another thing from the Samyutta Nikaya. And he's trying to use an image to explain this question. When bhikkhus, a carpenter or a carpenter's apprentice, looks at the handle of his adze, he sees the impressions of his fingers and his thumb, but he does not know. So much of the adze handle has been worn away today, so much yesterday, so much earlier. But when it is worn away, the knowledge occurs to him that it has worn away. So basically what the Buddha is saying is, you'll know when you know. When you've actually got to the other shore, you'll know. I can't explain better because I've never really been to the other shore. So I can just tell you what the Buddha is saying here very clearly. At a certain point, you know. This is a theme in the teachings that occurs in several other places as well. And I want to actually read bits of another sutta from the Majjhima Nikaya. This is sutta number 105. And in this sutta, it begins with a bunch of bhikkhus, a bunch of monks coming and saying to the Buddha, basically, we got to the other shore. We've done it. You know, it's like they declare that they've become emancipated, is what the word typically uses. So I want to read you some of this, so see how the Buddha talks about this. I've heard, Venerable Sir, that a number of bhikkhus have declared final knowledge in the presence of the Blessed One. Did they do so rightly? Or are there some bhikkhus here who declare final knowledge because they overestimate themselves? It's a polite way of putting it, right? They overestimate themselves. When those bhikkhus declared final knowledge in my presence, there were some bhikkhus who declared final knowledge rightly, and there were some who declared final knowledge because they overestimated themselves. Therein, when bhikkhus declare final knowledge rightly, their declaration is true. But when bhikkhus declare final knowledge because they overestimate themselves, the Tathagata, that's the Buddha, thinks, I should teach them the Dhamma. Ah, time to teach them more, right? Then further on, there's various images that the Buddha uses that describe what it would mean to be true on the other shore. It is possible that some person here may be intent on the imperturbable. another word for emancipation and realization. When a person is intent on the imperturbable, only talk concerning that interests him, and his thinking and pondering are in line with that, and he associates with that kind of person, and he finds satisfaction in that. But when talk about worldly material things is going on, he will not listen to it or give it ear or exert his mind to understand it. He does not associate with that kind of person. He does not find satisfaction in that. And then he has this wonderful image. Just as a yellow leaf that has fallen from its stalk is incapable of becoming green again, so when a person is intent on the imperturbable, he has shed the fetter of worldly material things. He should be understood as a person detached from the fetter of worldly material things, who is intent on the imperturbable. And then he goes on further. It is possible that some person here may be completely intent on Nibbana. When a person is completely intent on Nibbana, only talk concerning that interests him, and his thinking and pondering are in line with that, and he associates with that kind of person, and he finds satisfaction in that. But when talk about the base of other things, he will not listen, and he will not give ear and exert his mind to understand it. And then here's another image. Just as a palm tree with its top cut off is incapable of growing again, so too, when a person is completely intent on Nibbana, his fetter has been cut off at the root, made like a palm stump, done away with so that it is no longer subject to future arising. The beauty of this is, I think, the images, you know, the leaf that falls off the branch, the palm stump. These are things that people listening to the Buddha teach would immediately understand. They're like deeply cultural. This was living in India. This is what people saw. They saw palm trees. They cut off the top of a palm tree. And not unlike, you know, like deciduous trees, once you cut off the top, nothing grows. That's it. It's a stump. And it's finished. No new palm tree pops up out of the ground from where you cut it off. And the leaf falling off, well, how often do you see that? Right? It turns yellow and it falls off. I'm a gardener, so I see this a lot. So this is what's happening. It's like, it happens slowly. Like as we're going across the flood, as we're applying effort with our hands and our feet, we're not stopping, but we're not flailing around and straining. Imperceptibly, it happens. We start to shift towards this place of being on the far shore. And it's, so it's not like, you know, you turn on a light switch. It's really, what's important is that we keep practicing and that we understand at some level, at least, that it's this process of practice that's important. The end point will happen. But it's not, we don't want to become obsessed with the endpoint. We want to become obsessed. If we're obsessed with anything, we're obsessed with the practice, with the process of practice. That's what's important. And then over time, the adze handle wears away, the leaf will drop off, the palm tree will get beheaded, however, whatever image you like. But it's the process that's important. It's this slow, imperceptible process that is what we need to pay attention to. And to do that, there's a little note I put here. You see, we have to take the resolve and get wet. We have to actually form the intention to get wet and do something about it. We can't just ignore it. We have to choose to get wet, which is difficult. It's unpleasant. Who likes being wet? But that's what the practice requires. So I want to read one more thing here. This is another poem by Dana Falls called Life Here at the Edge. When love lights a fire in the heart, don't be so quick to quell the flames. To be fully alive is to welcome the beloved in countless names and guises, not turn away the wild with the tame. Drink your fill of longing. Let love wash through in waves that lift you up and carry both your daring and your fear straight to unknown places. Yes, there's danger in not staying safely cloaked in morality and labels, but there's life here at the edge, and a choice to be made between thoughtful abandon and passionate restraint. The plaintive cry of the heart can be ignored only at the price of a fully realized life. Throw arms wide to possibilities that move and call you to come forth in freedom and in fullness. Trust the seed of grace within to blossom without sin or sorrow. For you are surely big enough to hold the truth as it unfolds. That's a pretty good description of process, I think. So at this point, I'm going to stop talking, except maybe to answer your question.